So a little bit of my presentation will follow the traditional route. So if you open a standard book, you're going to see many things familiar there. But then slowly I'll transition into something that I think, especially in computational physics of PDEs, there has been a gradual transition into more rigorous ways of presenting things. So I'm just going to be moving there. But for the first kind of half an hour or so, we're going to be discussing things that are more general and things that you could recognize when opening a book on partial differential equations and how to discretize and implement them numerically. But before you actually attend to this, so let me just tell you my particular opinion on this. So one thing that I hate with the partial numerical recipes, I think that's a book you should never open until you know what you're doing. Then you go and open it to find out or remind yourself of how to do a particular thing. Don't think you're going to learn from that book. There are too many crimes that have been committed because of that book. There is also too many crimes that have been committed because of undesolved, say in mathematics. Mathematica, people open, so oh, I can punch this, it'll give me a solution. You need to understand what's going on in there. So before you do that, let's just try and understand that how some things happen, and so that once you get the solution, you can understand where it is the solution you're looking for, and then how to analyze it. I cannot stress enough the importance of visualization. Typically, if you're doing a problem numerically, it's because you don't know the answer. You're trying to get the code to give you intuition of what the solution should be. And especially if you're trying to tackle a problem that hasn't been tackled before, and typically that's the case in physics, you don't really know much about the solution itself. So you need to interact, and we're going to talk about how is it, what kind of questions you want to ask your solution once you've obtained it to actually convince yourself that you're on the right track. So, I mean, generically, or less as a driving kind of topics, we're going to be talking about PDEs. I'm going to start with one particular type, just because I think it's a richer one, and many of the things we discuss carry over to all other PDEs. But as time progresses, I'll move to the R ones and discuss peculiarities of them. But let's say there are rigorous ways of defining the types. But let me just start with examples. So in the context of PDEs, we recognize there are equations that we call parabolic. And of course, an archetypical example is a heat equation. And if I were to write it this way, so it would be kind of governed by an equation of this form. So the second spatial derivative, say we're thinking one dimension, is related to, gives the rate of change of the time derivative. And it has a, we're going to understand this better, but it has a well-defined evolution to the future, but not to the past. But we'll discuss that in a few minutes. There is hyperbolic, and this is the one I'll start working with, because it's, this is the one I consider the richer one. And in some sense, the most delicate to implement. The archetypical examples of hyperbolic equations are Maxwell's equations, let's say. And Navier-Stokes. With viscosity equal to zero. And that's the simplest possible hyperbolic equation we can think of is of this type, which has its own name. It's called the advection equation. Let me change this lambda, because we're going to use lambda for something else later. Let's put an A. We have elliptic equations, and of course, Poisson equation is an example. And in particular, some solutions of both parabolic or hyperbolic, some particular scenarios that are described by either parabolic or hyperbolic equations, give solutions that are solutions of elliptic equations. So in a problem, you say, well, I'm looking for stationary solutions, this is gone, and then the equation you have is a parabolic equation. So in some sense, these two include these ones. And there are ways of solving elliptic equations that actually call for redefining the problem in terms of a parabolic problem, and then you obtain the solution through relaxation. This is why I said that I tend to think this one as richer as this other one, and in some sense containing them. And then there's Schrodinger equations, which is in some sense separate from all these other ones, but it does share some characteristic. So, but we're going to concentrate on this one to begin with. So the first thing we want to recognize is that the numerics is just an artifact. It's just something, it's a tool. It's something we want to use to obtain the solution. It shouldn't be the means. So I work on the so-called field of numerical relativity, but I'm adamant to say that field doesn't exist. The numerics is just a tool. And the best code is a code that at the end of the day you want to throw away because you've learned everything out of it. So I don't even waste time naming my codes. I come from Argentina. You don't name the animal you're going to kill, so might as well. It's just code to do something. But underlying all this is our belief, and we can ask that particular question, and we should ask that particular question, that a problem is what satisfies this condition, which is so-called well-posedness, which is a concept introduced by Hadamard in the early 1900s, but it's the obvious one. I mean, it's the one that says, if we're going to do physics, which is described by some set of PDEs, that those PDEs, with the right conditions, should satisfy these three power properties. The solution should exist. Of course, otherwise we wouldn't be working for it. The solution should be unique. Because we believe we're dealing with a predictive science, and where the solution should be unique. We shouldn't be just randomly getting one or another solution. And also the solution, and this is a mouthful, but let me just write it and then explain what it is, must depend continuously on initial data and boundary conditions. So pictorially, what we mean by that is that if you have, let's say, some given problem, and this is the space of solutions of that problem, and here is your space of initial configurations of that problem, if you pick one set of initial configurations and boundary conditions, then at a later time, then I give you this solution. This third statement says, if you pick an initial condition that is sufficiently close to this one, the solution at a later time will be sufficiently close to the other solution, and that sufficiently could actually be divergent, could be exponentially going away from this solution, but it should be such that if I take the limit of this one going to this first condition, this one will get to that first solution. So, again, this is physics. We don't ever think that we have absolutely complete control of the conditions or the state of a system. We have them in a very good approximation, but we never have 100% knowledge of it. And that should be still enough for us to predict where the solution properties at a later time. That later time might be very short or maybe very long. That depends on the peculiarities of the problem we're dealing with. So this underlines even the attempt to try and get the solution at the analytical level, and so much so on the numerical side. If this property is not satisfied, we shouldn't even be wasting our time. We have to fix first the problems at the mathematical, at the analytical level, and then we can attempt to try and do some particular computation. So we're going to start thinking of hyperbolic problems. And okay, we start at equations, we know examples of them, we know that those equations typically have a few properties. So they describe evolution in time, so there's a dynamics in them, which is what generically what we're trying to obtain. This implies a need for initial conditions, at least. So if we have a problem that has no boundaries, we're considering the full infinite domain, and we're trying to obtain the dynamics of some of the system under some initial configurations, then this is called the initial value problem for that particular set of equations. So given some initial conditions, we want to obtain what the evolution, the dynamics of the future of that is. And if on the other hand we have a bounded domain, we also need boundary conditions. And then the problem turns into the so-called initial boundary value problem. So it's just, there's an extra letter there, which means you actually have to be worried about what is it that you're, what condition you're given. You have a domain that might be close, that is close. So in addition to the solution or the initial configuration there, you also need to specify conditions on the sides. So that's at the analytical level. At the numerical level, it will be the case generically, though there are examples, there are easy counterexamples, where even though you may be thinking of the infinite domain, just because of computational resources, you're never going to be able to put the full infinite domain on your computational grid. So you're going to artificially introduce boundaries. And that will introduce some features that we have to be careful with. The boundary conditions here might not be something we know how to give. And we're going to have to deal with the fact that these conditions here will affect the physics in the interior, even though we're trying to do a problem that shouldn't have boundaries influencing. So that will be something we're going to have to work for. And we're going to discuss that as we go along. So now as we try to then turn a mathematical problem rooted in the physics into a problem we can solve, we need to now just make some decisions. So we want to kind of move into the computational side of things. So we need to decide on a few conditions that will guide how we're going to do our problem. So of course, first we need to come with a complete understanding, at least formally, of the structure of equations that we're going to solve, the type of initial conditions, the type of boundary conditions that we can bring. So that would be the problem we want to solve. Once we have that, we need to decide on a way to discretize the system. And this is the step where we actually turn a continuum problem into a discrete problem, a problem that we can solve through algebra. Then we're going to solve the problem, which will require a whole set of tests for faithfulness of the solution. We want to make sure that at the end of the day, not only can we convince ourselves that the solution is correct, but we can convince the rest of the world. So we're going to be talking primarily of these things. But when needed, we're going to go back to the mathematics to try and get some guidance out of it to deal with this problem. Any questions? So far, I've been talking about generalities. So when we, let's think of we're moving to this step now. We want to discretize the system of equations, which generically means all the continuum has to be translated into a discrete representation. That involves choosing some strategy, some discretization strategy. And there are many. There are many options that one can choose from. I'm just going to list some of them. And we're going to adopt one particular one. So there is, in some sense, one of the oldest ones, finite difference approximations. There is finite volume. There is finite element. And there is, say, spectral. And there are others that you know, related in some sense to this one. If you go around and you ask people what working computational modeling, what type of techniques you're using, you're gonna get a whole bunch of answers. But if you tell them, I'm using finite differences, generically, an engineer will laugh at you. So why are you using something that is so old when there are all these other methods, especially these ones here, that give you a whole lot of a much better accuracy for less code? The answer to that kind of criticism is, yes, but you're never solving a problem that someone else hasn't solved before. You're just tweaking whatever. You're designing a bridge. You're just tweaking a previous bridge to design that one. So you have the luxury of using something that's very fine-tuned for a particular purpose. You're not in the discovery mode. In the discovery mode, you want something that's the most flexible, that is rather natural, and for a bunch of reasons, finite differences is a natural way to go. It doesn't give you the most efficient way, but it gives you something that's so generic or so generally applicable that is a very flexible one. Also, the entry cost to come and use this technique is very, very low. So if you just know the basic of calculus, that's more than enough to use this, to know exactly what this technique is doing. So we're gonna do this. Later on, I might just say some features of this, but we're gonna just take as our workhorse the finite difference. In particular, one thing that finite differences also gives us is a very simple way, and this is something we're gonna discuss later, to assess the error of our solution. And as I said, that would be the third problem. Once we have a solution, we want to make sure we can argue very strongly that we have a solution to our problem, and we understand everything about it. It costs some work, but it's in finite differences, it's a very natural thing to do. So let me illustrate with one example. And try to kind of slowly go from the analytics into the discrete. And we're gonna just start with a simple example where everything I'm gonna say now is just at the continuum level. Suppose you have the wave equation. Just a 1D second order equation. So this is the problem that we would like to solve. In and on itself, it seems, this is a problem that should be well posed, it should be satisfying these conditions. But the answer is no. There is no way, if you give me this problem, that we could have a unique solution, because I haven't told you everything. I need to tell you what is the initial condition. And the initial condition will be, of course, some phi x at t equal to 0 is something. Phi comma t at x t equal to 0 is something else. I have to say, well, do I have boundaries or not? And if I have boundaries, I have to understand what piece of information should we be given to this problem. But for the sake of this point, let's assume that the boundaries are x is in minus infinity to infinity. So how would a mathematician try to attempt and prove that under this, you can prove that the system is well posed? So one standard method is called an energy method. Let me just show you the steps, and I'm gonna be sloppy. I'm not gonna be carrying all factors of two that are floating around, because at the end it doesn't matter. Let me define an energy, and in this case, the energy just happens to coincide with the physical energy, but in general, that doesn't have to be the case. It has to be one norm associated to the solution, to the variables in your problem, and if you can prove that that norm doesn't blow up arbitrarily fast, then you can establish well posed. So suppose we construct this energy, and this energy will be governed by the evolution equations underlying our problem. So we can ask what happened with that energy in time. So I'll take a time derivative of that. So I'll replace here, and here is where I'm dropping factor of two already. Prime denotes radial derivative, dot denotes time derivative. So this will be prime dot. At this level, I can now use the evolution equations, because we have, in this step, we have not told the system or the analysis what is our underlying equation. So if I replace it by that one, this will be phi dot, now phi double prime. Now I can, this term, I can iterate by parts and change it into dx, and I'm going to put the x so that it's clear. But interchangeably, I'm using the prime and the dx, phi dot, phi prime, minus phi dot prime, phi prime, plus phi prime, phi dot prime. So these two terms are equal to each other. We have the opposite sign. They drop. And so I have now E dot is equal to the total gradient of phi dot phi prime. And then this is just E. This is just this evaluated at the boundaries. But our boundaries were at infinity, and if we assume that we have a compact supported initial data, at least for a while, this says E dot is zero. So that means the energy of my system has to stay bounded. It has to stay equal to the original one. So there is a bound. There is a natural bound, and it couldn't be anything blowing up. So in here, there were a few things that we're going to try slowly to reproduce. We took the time derivative, because that's something we do at the continuum level. We iterated by parts. That's something else we do at the continuum level. And then we get a bound for the energy. So I'm going to present you a few kind of standard ways of discretizing this problem. But later on, we're going to revisit, and we're going to find better ways to discretize a system motivated in trying to reproduce these steps. So we're going to come up with derivative operators that satisfy the analog of iteration by parts. We're going to say that we're going to use some particular recipes to iterate in time to respect kind of this role. But at the moment, as I said, I want to, just because of the typical literature, I'm going to follow a little bit the typical literature, and then we're going to get fancier. So I'll come back to this one later. So let's start with talking about discretization itself. So we said we're going to use finite differences. So finite differences, what one does is first the continuum domain. So let's say the any continuum variable where our fields kind of live on will be translated into a discrete version. So for instance, if we have the axis, the spatial axis, we're going to discretize that and then say, well, instead of having that continuum, we're going to have a grid that just spans some values of it. For simplicity, we're going to assume that that grid goes to this discrete x sub j, and j is our an index that just labels the different points. And let's say it's equal to, for the sake of the argument here, it's j minus 1 times delta x, where delta x is the spacing in between points. And again, for simplicity, we're going to assume that these points are equally separated, the simplest possible way. We can then modify it and extend it and have a non-uniform grid. But for easy description, let's just imagine that's the case. Also, I'm very quickly going to replace delta x by h so that we can carry a simpler thing. On that grid, if we have a function, let's say something that has that shape, we're going to say the function of x is now represented by the discrete version of the function at the points of the grid. Be just that. Of course, obviously, as you take h going to zero, then first your grid will become, we'll have a larger number of points, and the spacing between the points will get arbitrarily close as much as you can afford, and you're going to do a better and better description in describing that function. One obvious thing we can do, and we're going to be doing it back and forth a few times, is to kind of picture in our heads kind of what Fourier modes would we accommodate in that grid, because we know we can use Fourier as a basis and then just always describe any functions with respect to those modes. That will give you will give us a sense of what's the highest kind of variation that our grid can accommodate. And obviously, you can imagine that the highest one is this one, right, where the function goes from here and changes sign from point to point. Right? If we think of any higher frequency than that, we're not going to be able to represent it. Right? In particular, if we double the grid size, if we double the frequency of our solution, of the function we're trying to describe, let's imagine that's that one. With respect to how our grid thinks that solution is to be represented, we just find a value of here, another here, another here, another here. And as far as that grid is concerned, what we have is a constant function. So this is an illustration of how badly we're representing that particular function. So we have to be careful with that. And so there is a context of the maximum wave number that we can accommodate, and that's just pi divided by this h. And what generically happens, regardless of the technique, is if you're exploring any function that is exploring the largest frequency you can accommodate, you're actually doing a bad job describing it. And so you always need to make sure that you have a fine enough grid to represent whatever features of the solution you're exploring. So with that, let's just now try and do the next steps. So we choose a discrete grid. So now we have a way to discretize our variables. Now we need a way to represent operators. So we have our function is now a collection of values of functions at points. Our space and time would be discretized this way. And now we want to turn into the derivative operators. So as I said, one reason why finite differences are so easy to adopt is that they don't require anything from you except that you remember Taylor series. So let's imagine again that we have our grid. Now our function is, I'm not allowed to draw a continuous line. I have, say, values of the function here and here and there. And we can ask, what's the derivative here? Because we're after discretizing, let's say, this equation. So we can say, well, let's just see, taking these three points, let's call this point J, let's call J plus 1, let's call J minus 1. How could we represent the derivative of the function at the point J? So an easy way of doing that is to think that with respect to any point in here, we can do a Taylor approximation centered around the point J. So we're after trying to obtain an expression for this, the derivative of the value of the function u evaluated at point j. So I can say, well, the function u at the point j plus 1, which I'm assuming is sufficiently smooth, and I can assume this because I have done the due diligence in putting a grid that is sufficiently fine that with respect to the local neighborhood of this point, we have the function being smooth. So this is, I can use this Taylor again. And this is just simply x, the point j, plus h squared divided by 2 at the point j, plus h cubed divided by 6. Etc. The And remember, this is what we're going to use at the space that, that we're discretizing in uniform grid. Of course, the value of the function at point j with respect to j is just itself. And at the j minus 1, it's very similar to that one, except that we have some minus signs. And our assumption of smoothness allows us to do this. So now we can just say, well, how can we combine these three values to obtain an approximation to the derivative? And so we can say, well, imagine combining, introducing three coefficients such that we combine things in this way. Let's say C minus UJ minus 1 plus C 0 uj plus c plus uj plus 1 has to be equal to the derivative next uj plus some error. And we're going to see what that error is. So, I mean, you can do this. It's a very trivial exercise. But if you choose the following values, c minus as 1 minus 2h, c 0 equals 0, and C plus is 1 divided by 2H. What you have is, in the right-hand side, the first term that shows up is this one. I said like the derivative that you were looking for. Because we're dividing by H, it precisely gives us UX, the derivative of U at the point J. And then this error is of order H squared. And I leave it as an exercise for you to kind of derive this. And also tell me h squared is multiplying what? So we find now, then after that, straightforward exercise is that the approximation to the derivative of a function at the point j, which sometimes we're just going to change so that we don't misunderstand that d is the continuous derivative, but actually it's the partial derivative. The discrete derivative at j is given by this expression. So two order h squared in our spacing, just taking the value of the function to the left and to the right of the point of interest divided by 2h subtracted, that gives us an approximation to the derivative. And of course, this is general. I never told you j, well, we're saying this space, but if we flip the axis around and we think of time, the same we can use for taking time derivative.
Sorry.
Yes.
Oh, why won't you use j plus 1 and j minus 1? You just use u j and j plus 1. You can also call them out
yeah.
of magnitude.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. So I'm going to, so let's say some homework exercise. Indeed. So one is, let me just say something else. So get an approximation that is of order h to the fourth. For the derivative. So just try and work it out. You would need to involve more points, very likely, but try to do that. So using the same technique, that now the second derivative of u at the point j is given by uj plus 1 minus 2 uj plus uj minus 1 divided by h squared plus order h squared. So show this. So this is the way you can, again, involve the three points. Though in this case, the point in the middle in reality never played a role. Here it comes in. But this combination gives you the second derivative to order h squared. 3 show that if you do D of U of J and you find it this way, this is equal to the derivative, the continuous derivative evaluated in J plus some order H. That's precisely your question. If we only involve 2 points, we have a kind of a more compact scheme, but on the other hand, we're paying a price that our error is scaling weaker in some sense. And also show that D of D of U using, let's say, this recipe is different from the D square U defined this way. So the first derivative acting on the first derivative will give you something that is different from the second derivative that we defined this way. In both cases, the error will be order H square, but the number of points you're going to involve are different. So are we clear on that so far? Yes.
So D should be the derivative operator.
D is the derivative, the discrete derivative operator. So what we're seeing here is, let's say, just if we compare this one with that one. So the first thing is that there is not unique derivative operator. It depends on what your choice is, where the error, the target of error that you're going after is. And so if you're going to a higher order, so this is when you look at this one. This one. When you are trying to get something of order h to the fourth, you're going to involve several more points. That price might be worthwhile taking, because you're going to have something that gives you an associated error that is much smaller. Of course, your computation will be higher, because now you have to involve more points. But the trade-off might be very good. And in fact, there are rigorous results that they said, well, at fourth order, you're gaining more than the extra work you have to do to get it. Beyond that, well, it depends on the application. The gain is not as significant. But as a starting point, we're just going to stay low, order h squared or order h, and we're going to push forward. And you'll see that everything we do really translate very quickly into arbitrary choices that you may have. Notice the other thing we're not so far discussing, but we will, is the presence of boundaries. So this gives you the derivative. Let's say if you're insisting on using this one, this is fine to do it everywhere where you have an interior point, but the moment you get to a boundary point, you might not have a point to the left or to the right to evaluate the derivative. We're going to discuss that. And this is, depending what choices you make, there are different issues that will come about. So if you open a typical book on numerical methods, especially for hyperbolic PDEs, all of a sudden you're going to have names. So it used to be back in the days where if you came up with a name for a particular algorithm, you could name the algorithm would be associated to your name. Nowadays, I think it's much less obscure, but we're going to show you some examples, and then we're going to try to dispel that magic behind names. So let's imagine, just let's bite the bullet and go straight through trying to implement how we would go about trying to implement this equation, A u comma x. So remember what I said, before you even try and do anything numerically, try and milk as much as you can from the analytical side what you expect from that equation. So this is a first order equation. We know that in order to iterate it, we need initial conditions here. We see only one time derivative, so we just need one condition here, which is the value of the field, because with that we can advance to the future. We also, and this we'll look in more detail later, probably not today, we also can ask the question, if I put a little perturbation here, wherever, we can ask, is it going to move to the left or to the right? We're talking about hyperbolic equations. Hyperbolic equations typically will have perturbations that propagate without given speed. And then we can find out, let me just for simplicity imagine that A is 1. And we can always do that, because if I redefine my time, I can absorb that A. So the typical solution to this problem is any general function that will be determined by the initial condition of the variable of the argument t plus x. So this is something that moves from right to left. If I put a perturbation here and I wait a little bit later, it's going to move to the left. So this also will tell me, and we're going to look into this in more detail, that if I need a boundary condition, I can only put it here. I cannot put it here because it will be determined by the evolution itself. So it's moving from right to left. And this feature, we might be able to exploit later on when we try to do this discretization. And that's what we're going to discuss now. So let's imagine that we're going to try to do, using our best method so far to order h squared, let's use it to try and understand how to implement a system of equations or a discrete set of equations that will tell us how that should be evolved to the future. So I can imagine that my grid is like that. So these are my grid points in space. Time is running that way. For simplicity, for the time being, let's imagine that there are no boundaries. We have the system is periodic, so we identify this first point in the grid with that last point on that side. And we want to just iterate this. As I said, everything we describe on the spatial part, we can also describe it on the time part. So we can imagine that just as we define the grid this way, we could have an associated grid in time, tn, which we're going to give it, say, n minus 1 for n for time, times delta t. So I now put another index. So the index j was one that ran over the spatial domain. N will run over the time domain. So our function phi or u at t and x, we can, using our discrete assumption, we can only know at time tn, index n, and point xj's. And then our notation would be this. So this says time label n, space label j. The other thing that we're going to introduce, which is very useful, is to tie delta t to h. So h was the spacing in the spatial direction. This is the spacing in the time direction. Let's assume that we're going to introduce a particular number now, delta x, lambda, which has its own fancy name, or courant. There's a courant number. And we're going to find out that this lambda is actually very crucial to have even a chance of obtaining the solution. But the good thing is that once we fix the lambda, we have a single parameter, which is the spacing h, that will tell us how fine our grid is. So if I just reduce h, make it much smaller, I have many more time slicing in the direction of time and much more dense grid in space. So we can now use this, use our operator, both in space and time, to try and do iterate this equation. We're going to do the simplest possible thing. We're not trying to be smart. We're just trying to plug through. And again, this is what is the danger of using something like numerical recipes without thinking what you're really doing. So let's just imagine that now, remember, the derivative here skips the midpoint. So if I think of space, or sorry, in time, OK, I can have that slice, this slice, so this n plus 1. N and n minus 1. And so if I take these 2 points, the value of the function here minus the value of the function there, divided by twice delta t, I have an approximation to the time derivative. Right. And we can do the same thing in space. So we turn this equation into, and now I have put this sub-index t and x to remind ourselves that one is in the time direction and the other in the space direction. So here will be u n plus 1 minus u n minus 1 at the point j divided by 2 h to delta t, which we then will change it for lambda delta x, but let me just keep it explicit there. And this one, well, this one we have a choice now, and then we have to discuss what that choice is. So this gives us a second order derivative operator, remember, a second order accurate, so accurate to order h squared, if we evaluate here at this point. Right? This one was a derivative, the second order h squared, so second order accurate approximation to the derivative at the point in the middle. So we can choose these two points to evaluate the spatial derivative here. That gives us, in the right-hand side, an error that is order h squared. And these two points to evaluate the time derivative there, which gives us a second-order error. So this will be plus order delta t squared. And I can do u n j plus 1 minus u n j minus 1 divided by 2 delta x plus order delta x squared. Right, is all this clear? So when we do this, now we can say if we're advancing our field, we had an equation that is only first order. So if I know several levels, and say this is the last level that I know everything about, then this recipe will take me to the next level. We'll begin defining the functions, the value of the functions at the next level, because I know the previous one. And let's imagine that we have the issue of initializations we can discuss later. Let's imagine we have enough levels. So this will give us a recipe, and the recipe is like so, un plus 1 and j is equal to un level minus 1 as j plus, so I multiply by 2 delta t, and I replace it by lambda delta x, so I can simplify that one. It's lambda un j plus 1 minus un j minus 1 over, that's it. So the first thing we notice is that everything in the right-hand side we know. So we have a single unknown, which is the value of the function at the new level, the one that we're trying to solve for. And everything in the right-hand side we know. This is because it either involves information at level n minus 1 or information at level n. So this is an example of a so-called explicit scheme. It's in a scheme where every single point that we're obtaining a function of involves things that we already know. There are other methods, which of course, as opposed to this one, will be the implicit scheme, where the unknown shows up in the left-hand side at more than one point, and you have to solve everything at once. So there will be an inversion and matrix operation, which we'll discuss a little briefly later. What the consequences or what the implications of that are, but at the moment we're going to consider explicit schemes, primarily because if we're thinking of nonlinear problems, implicit schemes are very difficult to implement. Sometimes you may have in the right-hand side the value of the function squared. So if I had this one, for instance, here, just trying to obtain a clean variable to solve for when we have terms like that is very delicate on the implicit scheme. So usually one avoids that. But there are ways around. So now we have this. And that would be a recipe. We can put that in the computer and go. But lots of things can happen. Lots of things can go wrong. And this is where I said crimes get committed all the time. But let's see what we do. So imagine what this is. This is, says generically that the value of the function at level n plus 1, point j, is a function of things that happened at a previous level. And of course, they themselves satisfy a rule like that. So you can see that by induction, this would be like f of eventually the zeroth level to some power n plus 1. right? Because you just keep using the same scheme to advance from level 0 to 1, from 1 to 2, from 2 to 3, and then you can unravel this by saying the value of the function level n plus 1 has to do with some operator that acted n plus 1 times on my initial information. So if that's true, and this is just now an observation that is generic, notice that what you have is this operator, let's just call it O, acting on n plus 1 times on the initial data, better be such that its norm, or some norms in some sense, if we can diagonalize this and there are eigenvalues associated to it, it better be that this is less or equal to 1. So why I'm pulling one fast here, I'm watching time. I didn't want to wrap up with this, but let me just kind of, I think schematically this would be easy to see. Suppose you go from here to there and you utilize, let's say, 4 steps. So you have an operator acting 4 times on the initial conditions, and I'll give you the solution. But now you also want to then make sure your solution is as good as you think it is, so you reduce the step size from delta t to delta t divided by 2, and delta x to delta x divided by 2. Then now the number of steps to go from the initial time to the final step has doubled. So the number of times that you apply this operator has doubled. And if the norm have to be larger than 1, then geometric series will tell us this is going to blow up. So this is something that we'll have to be very mindful of. There will be a way to assign a weight to this operator, which will depend on this lambda. And this is why this lambda, which seemed to be a silly thing to put a number, a special name for, is just a ratio of delta time over delta x. Well, that ratio, the reason it's called has its own name is because these eigenvalues here that better be bounded by 1 will be governed intrinsically by this lambda. And so we're going to find schemes that for some restricted values of lambda will work, but not for others. And there are schemes that no matter what value of lambda we use, will be completely wrong. So let me just give you one sort of analysis and then just throw an exercise which we're going to go through on Friday. So let's imagine we want to analyze what this scheme is actually doing. So imagine U and J. Again, we're going to use our Fourier analysis. So every now and then, thinking that way is actually very useful. We can say that this is kind of some S, which we're going to try to bound. It's something that will be telling us something about this operator. L raised to the nth power times e to the I k j delta x or k j h. Right, so we have something in space. So in space, we introduce this Fourier representation. We kind of go back to the continuum, but we're evaluating at the discrete point. And then this is something that we're yet going to determine. We're going to try to determine what this S is. And we're going to ask that S to have norm bounded by 1. Right? Because the norm of this one, this has norm 1, and this is what we're going to be asking, is this bounded by 1? And if it is, then this operator will be bounded. If I replace this in here, then I have to, like, this term will be S m plus 1 e to the I k j delta, or h, while here will be S to the n e to the I k j plus 1 h. So you can replace this in this way and then solve, simplify everything you can simplify, and then you're going to see that you have this equation. S is equal to 1 over S plus 2 lambda I sine of k h. And then with this, you can solve for S and then ask, what's the norm of S? And is it less or equal to 1? And does it depend on lambda and how. So it's a specific way of understanding where the scheme you have just constructed without even starting to do a numerical simulation, where you have a chance of it being stable. And all the schemes that are out there that have particular names, Lax-Wendroff, Krag-Nicholson, tons of them, at the end of the day it tells you, oh, within this lambda, Runge-Kutta, within this lambda, things are okay. And that's what this means. So if you do this analysis, and there is a simpler way of, there is a more involved way of doing it, but it's a very simple, for very simple schemes, simple ways of understanding where you have a chance of having a stable evolution or not. So we're gonna, on Friday, we're gonna look at this, and hopefully you can then try and implement different methods using this equation. And funnily enough, you might think that this equation is too simple, even the kind of equations you may have in the back of your head that you might want to be iterating. But if you're dealing with a hyperbolic problem where well posing is satisfied, generically what will happen is that you can reduce the problem to something that looks like a sequence of these things. And if this is true, then you have a good starting point here, then you're home free. This was very, very famous applied mathematician, Heinz Otto Kreis, has a book this thick, which is amazing, and the book only describes this equation. Goes on and on and on through different methods of that equation and kind of different rigorous ways of understanding how to do the implementation. So I think we need to stop because there is a colloquium, but if you have any questions, let me know. Let me just kind of briefly say what I wanted to say today, at least. So first, we need to make sure that on the mathematical side, we have as much control as possible from the equation. That control will come and be very useful in everything we do. Eventually, when we are starting to talk about boundary conditions, we're going to use it very explicitly. Knowing as much as possible at an analytical level will tell us what particular recipes or ways of doing things we can use and what things we shouldn't. So again, when we look at boundary conditions, we'll see this very explicitly. But on Friday, we're also going to look at other options to discretize this thing. We're going to see that some options are generically bad no matter what we do, no matter the value of lambda. But having a good intuition of what the equation, what the solutions of the equation should be behaving like will also allow us in a very simple way to fix those problems and then have something that works. Any questions? So I know you guys use Julia. I don't even know who Julia is, I would say. But if you have Julia or whatever, Mathematica, Maple, Mathcat, you could just play around. Remember what the ingredients were to discretize things? How, just refresh your memory or just look up a little bit on how to do that. How to define an array of numbers. How to define that, I would say, an array of an array. So if I think of, remember, this one, U, N, J. So we need an array of two legs, one that might run through time, another one that runs through space. That would be good enough to just begin to do the try. In reality, you actually don't want to run over all levels because that will just eat up your memory. Imagine that you want to evolve for a year. Then you're going to have too many levels when you, after just doing a couple of steps, the previous steps are not useful anymore. You don't use it for everything. So with just two levels, it's fine. So usually, if I have two levels, I have u old of j and u new of j, and that's fine. But just try and set up things like this. Try to set up a grid of variables that will allow you to keep track of what's going on in space and time of this, and then this is what we're going to start doing on Friday so that you can get a little bit of experience evolving a particular equation. Okay.